It's been 3 years now since a vote about whether Britain should stay with the EU or leave split the country almost literally in half. In those 3 years, the world has watched one of our oldest democracies tear itself apart. Now, at one level, this has been a brawl over politics. At another, arguably, it's a good old-fashioned identity crisis. What kind of country does Britain want to be? Who'll live in it? Who'll run it? And can it return to being the small but powerful island of the past? Well, to wrestle with some of these questions, I'm joined now by barrister, academic, author and dual British and Australian citizen Geoffrey Robertson, who's lived between London and Australia for many decades now. Geoffrey, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Too long.
Look, it's been an astonishing 3 years, but this week it does seem to have hit peak crazy. And we're trying to assess the mood beyond just wrestling with the next political move. How, as people watch this theatre play out, how would you characterise it?
Well, it's a very British comedy. It's a bit like Monty Python now, but it has revved up considerably as the prospect of a no-deal Brexit became almost a reality. And that will mean that there'll be a shortage of food, there'll be a shortage of medicine. It'll be like the war. The Australians will have to send food parcels to the British again in the short term. So it's been for 3 years a kind of constipation of the British process, because nothing of value has been done by Parliament. The papers have been incredibly boring, and over these tedious negotiations. But now that something has to be done in a matter of weeks, by October the 31st, it has concentrated people's mind, and we have the extraordinary behaviour of Boris Johnson, who I know reasonably well, and he's a crash or crash through is very much his motto, and he's had a very bad week. He's lost his proposal to go to the electorate and hopefully, or he hopes, to win an election. He's now bound to go and ask for extra time, and the Parliament has actually passed a law, it will be finalised on Monday, that rules out a no-deal Brexit. So tonight he's up at Balmoral, breaking another tradition by taking his girlfriend, the Queen. Lots of tut-tutting. The Queen has never had to host a promiscuous Prime Minister since Lloyd George, and even never took his girlfriends to Balmoral. So there's quite a bit of tut-tutting. And, of course, the last time that Cherie Blair spoke of in her book of going to Balmoral, she said it was so wet and miserable that all she could do was get under the covers with Tony and make a baby. So what's going to happen tonight with Boris is unpredictable. He's made a few.
Now, we've got a couple of, we're so intrigued by, in a way, the underlying personality audit or sort of self-sacrificing that the British seem to be going through. We've got a couple of grabs from people who've spoken in Australia, English people, and I think they're very instructive. The Financial Times writer Simon Cooper spoke to us earlier this year, and he had an interesting take. He was at university with Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's, of course, he's very much one of his guiding forces. And he says, this is Simon Cooper, that to understand what's driving Brexit, you need to go back there, right back to Oxford University. Let's listen.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brexit starts to be born when Margaret Thatcher, in about 1988, suddenly turns against Europe. She suddenly starts to feel, well, actually, Brussels is usurping our powers. And just before Rees-Mogg and I arrive at university, she gives her famous Bruges speech about how Brussels is turning into a European superstate. And then these boys that I'm talking about, they think, I'm not going to let that happen because I'm going to rule Britain, me and my class. I don't want Brussels muscling in. So in 1990, Dan Hannan, he's an intellectual, he's an ideologue, he's a kind of British nationalist, he creates with a couple of mates the Oxford Campaign for an Independent Britain in the Queen's Lane Coffee House on Oxford High Street. And Hannan doesn't stop there. He then spends the next 25 years agitating for Brexit and arguing and thinking about it, building networks. So some people say that that day in Oxford in 1990 is really where the Brexit campaign begins.
Now that's Simon Cooper, and I want to play you another bit of analysis, this time from Fintan O'Toole, Irishman, of course, not an Englishman. He's talking about what he calls the post-imperialist hangover.
One of the things I try to suggest is that part of what's going on here is a sort of post-imperial hangover, but in a strange way, like not in a way that it's not just imperial nostalgia, it's something more complex than that. And it is that in an imperial mindset, there are only two conditions. You know, it's very binary. You're either the imperial power or you're a colony, you know. You're either dominant or you're submissive. And I think it is just funny that the biggest selling English novel by far of the period leading up to Brexit is about dominance and submission, right? Which is E.L. James's 50 Shades of Grey. The two main characters are referred to in it as the dominant and the submissive, you know, capital D, capital S, you know. And there's a funny business that one of the things that kind of feeds into Brexit is this sort of weird logic, right, which is, if it's binary and you could only be dominant or submissive, if we're not dominating the European Union, which we aren't, because that's not the way the European Union works, then the only other thing we can possibly be is submissive. And there's an almost kind of masochistic willing of yourself into this sort of self-pitying idea that you've been enslaved and dominated by the Europeans, and that therefore you have to sort of regain your national manhood somehow.
And that's Fintan O'Toole, who's, I think, written some of the most perceptive. Now, just those two perceptions characterising a particular sense of ennui or loss by that people who had ruled Britain and the Empire. Do you think that does help us attempt to understand?
Well, there's an element of that, and it is shown by the fact that overwhelmingly old people, by which I would say people over 75, voted to leave, whereas overwhelmingly young people, particularly university students, voted to stay. And a lot of the disputes in families are between the young, who see the old as having ruined their good, sophisticated, pro-European life in cosmopolitan places like London. So there is that element. There was also, you must remember, the Russian bloggers who are now appear to have been as active as they were in the American elections, pursuing anarchy in the West. And there were the racists, of course. There always are. And there was the journalistic, a lot of journalists turned into propagandists for one side or the other. Rupert Murdoch very cunningly allowed the Sun, or told the Sun, to stir up anti-European views, while the Times, his paper, of course, for intelligent people, was fair to the Remain case. But actually, I think that the most important factor was the same factor that brought Trump to power. It was the reaction of protest voters, really, who made the difference, because they had seen their standards of living and of life reduce because of austerity and so on, and they couldn't envisage them improving, whether by sticking with Brussels or sticking with Hillary. They thought that things couldn't get worse. They were wrong.
But I wonder, Geoffrey, whether in fact that
was a factor that was certainly in play in the Labour heartlands in the North, where the working class deserted the Labour policy and voted by and large to leave. But then in the 2017 election, they came back to Jeremy Corbyn, who ran a campaign that got a greater increase in Labour votes than had been seen since the war.
But Geoffrey, I wonder whether what Simon Cooper and, in a sense, Fintan O'Toole were on about, notwithstanding what you say, which I think is undoubtedly true, whether there was a group who effectively did feel, I'm going to rule Britain, me and my class, not others, and that, no. that in a way they led, that they turned out to be devilishly good propagandists, one could argue, that's a way to understand the madness, or it seems a madness.
Look, I was at Oxford 20 years before Simon, and I can identify what was called the Monday Club of Tory, young Tories who believed that they would get to power. Not that they weren't particularly old Etonians, they came from all parts, but they were hungry for power, and they saw it by developing racist or anti-European views. And John Major in the 1980s called them the bastards when they started to get into Parliament. And it was David Cameron, the Liberal Tory, who thought that he would extinguish them with this referendum. And how wrong he was. But there is, so I don't think it's an old Etonian plot. On the contrary, it is an you have the extraordinary situation of the Tory party, which has always been the party of business, actually saying, as Boris did, bugger business, and going for a power move which gets them into Downing Street in the, well, they hope it will, by playing on anti-European, somewhat racist fears. Mm. Whereas, of course, the land of England is owned 90% by the wealthy, and that won't change unless there is a Corbyn government. So I think, you know, we do have in Boris a kind of crash through someone who's not concerned about conventions, whether it's taking his girlfriend to sleep under the Queen's roof or whether it's proroguing Parliament in a way that's never been done before. He's got rid of Linton Crosby.
Has he? I didn't know that.
Yes, seems to have, because Linton Crosby is too principled. His new advisor is Dominic Cummings.
Dominic Cummings has replaced him.
Yeah. Who is unscrupulous.
If you watch that Brexit, the Uncivil War, the brilliant BBC drama about him, it's simply fantastic. Look, one last question, Geoffrey.
He's now running the place.
Yes, Britain's lived through other crises of national identity in the past. How do you think this one compares?
Well, I'm not as apocalyptic as many are. I think Britain will, the pound will collapse, you know, for Australians, the best time to visit Britain will be spring next year, when the pound will be below the Australian dollar. And the museums, the opera, the dramas in the theatre will all be fine, whatever nonsense is going on at a political level. And I think Britain obviously has the resilience to recover. But in the meantime, we are seeing this extraordinary development of democracy as a very unstable way of ruling. But I think the British are sensible enough at the end. What they will do is they'll have another referendum. That seems to be the talk today, rather than an election, which may resolve the situation if there's a clear majority one way or the other. Or they'll come up with, they'll have an election, which may well produce a Labour government in conjunction with the Liberals and the Scottish Nationalists. But if it does go wrong, we will see, firstly, the departure of Scotland. We will no longer have a United Kingdom.
There'll be no going to Balmoral and...
Balmoral will have to move.
Balmoral will have to move. All right. Geoffrey, thank you very much indeed for those observations.
All the best.
Geoffrey Robertson.